The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Today on Happy, Sad, Confused, Tim Roth on turning down Snape, television, and Tarantino. Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz. It's time for another episode of Happy, Sad, Confused. I'm Josh. This is Sammy.
That was like a melodic, beautiful in between the alliterations with the T's.
I'm just trying to be more soothing to the audience. I just feel
this
like my...
the ASMR podcast. Yeah,
my voice is so shrill and aggressive. I need to just like
we
mellow
want our
out.
Listeners to relax.
I want you to slowly get off the treadmill and think about
you
what
think
you've just
people
done.
Are listening to this while they're working out?
What do you think?
Is their pump-up, their pump-up podcast. I'm going to listen to Josh Horowitz and get my pump on.
I hope they don't put it that way.
Yeah.
I only work out to Tim Roth conversations.
As one should.
Yeah.
I think most of our listeners are probably in the car
yeah.
or walking.
See, I can't relate to the
work.
Car. As we know, I don't drive.
Yeah,
I try not to move
not at
around
all.
Much at all.
Yeah.
I did my podcasts in at the gym. I don't listen to music. I'd never listen to music at
yeah,
the gym.
Yeah, you're a psychopath. Like, I listen to the soothing sounds of NPR to work out.
I do. A little fresh air, a little Marc Maron.
Also, just to clarify in the intro, Tim Roth didn't turn down a sexual opportunity with Snape. He turned down the role of Snape, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
So, yes, to clarify, thank you.
Because I was confused.
Well,
yes.
Well, luckily, most of the audience is more intelligent and quick than you are, Sammy.
Well, you would think.
No. Yes, Tim Roth is the guest this week, and there's a lot to cover with Tim Roth because he's had an amazing career. He's sitting at 100 credits on IMDb
wow.
as we speak.
He
today.
Can't do anything else.
I told him that when he was leaving.
Yeah.
He's like, you might as well retire.
It's a nice number.
It is. He's promoting a new TV show that I very much enjoyed. I watched the first three episodes. It's called Tin Star. It's on Amazon Prime. It comes out September 29th. I looked at my notes. September 29th. It's a 10-episode run, and it's kind of like in that vein of a little Fargo-y, a little Noah Hawley kind of vibe. Like it's a little blend of like of violent drama, but a little bit of dark comedy to it too. Tim plays a like a small town cop, kind of fish out of water, who moves his family to I think it's like Calgary or Alberta. Beautiful landscape in Canada, and the shit hits the fan, right? I mean, like this is a show that grabs you from the start. If you watch it, the first scene is like a crazy moment, and then the last scene of the first episode is another crazy moment. So if it doesn't hook you by then, give up, because it's got a lot in the first episode, and I was very intrigued. And
he always plays real intense character. What's he like? I can't imagine.
Interesting.
Yeah.
He's actually in the conversation. I've never had a lengthy conversation with him before. He's very like, he just feels like comfortable in his own skin. Like, I mean, he's a bit of a neurotic in that, like, he talks about, you know, like many actors still, even at this amazing stage in his career, worrying about where the next job is coming from. But at the same time, he seems like, you know, he has a very a cool ease about him. And he's a really, actually a great conversationalist and tells some really good stories. It was a really fun chat about, I mean, the filmography of this guy, like when I started to like look at it, he's one of those guys that like, yeah, you've seen him in dozens of things. But I looked at the films he's done. He's just done so much great work. He was Oscar nominated, arguably for not like one of his most memorable performances, though Rob Roy is a pretty good film. But like, you know, obviously the Tarantino work, you know, he's done kind of a little bit of everything. Like he's worked with like everyone from like Woody Allen to Wim Wenders. And he's done, you know, the comic book movie Incredible Hulk. He's done TV before. He's just always working with interesting people and is always great. He's cut from that same cloth. He's the same generation as Gary Oldman. And they've done a couple films actually early on in their career together.
I'm surprised you didn't just stalk him about Gary Oldman then.
We talked a little bit about Gary Oldman, but,
even afterwards, like, so tell me, what did he eat? What did he,
Gotta get Gary on
you
the
love
podcast.
Gary? Yeah.
Everybody loves Gary. He's got, and Gary, hopefully, I'm definitely on that train because he's very much in the Oscar hunt for Darkest Hour. He plays Winston Churchill. So hopefully before Oscar season is said and done, we'll get Gary on the podcast.
Yeah, everybody secret it. Everybody put it into their...
Write a note. Put it in your hope chest.
Yeah.
But no, the man of the hour today is Tim Roth. And it's a conversation that touches on a lot of different things. And one of the things that, as I mentioned in the intro, is he... maybe infamously, maybe people know this, maybe people don't, he was offered the role of Snape in Harry Potter.
It's crazy.
I know.
And he's like, you know what? I don't think I'm going to do it.
Well, you know what he did? He did. He kind of took the Planet of the Apes role instead.
Oh.
Which, you know, I mean, there are pros and cons.
For all of us.
Well, I mean, look, Rickman did an amazing job. I'm sure Tim would have done a different kind of thing. He talks about like how he had a much different take.
Interesting.
So, this was a fun conversation with really one of our I wouldn't say underrated actors, but maybe it just take him for granted.
Underappreciated.
He's just always great. So, you know, hopefully decades more of fantastic performances coming. And certainly this show is a fine performance, and there's already second season greenlit. So.
Oh, that's a good sign.
Yes, always a good sign. What else to say, Sammy?
You just got back from Iceland.
Oh, yeah. I got back from Iceland.
You're so adventurous. It's amazing.
Look, guys, you know how I roll.
Did you do any spelunking?
Spelunking? What a great word.
Spelunking?
Spelunking. No, yeah. There was no spelunking. There was no extreme sports. Mm-hmm. But I did see a lot of wonderful nature. I was on a glacier for the first time.
Wow.
I went into a big cave.
And you're still
and found my
there.
Way out. Yeah. It was touch and go at times.
It looked like the inside of my brain.
I went to Cafe Loki.
At which... come on.
So, just for the record, I did not... It was actually...
For the record, everybody.
Because I was accused, not nefariously, but on Twitter I posted, or Instagram I posted a photo of me at Cafe Loki, which I thought was fun, considering, you know, our long association
with Mr. Hiddleston. The beautiful connection, yeah.
It was not my choice. It was actually my wife had selected this. It's a notable cafe restaurant in Reykjavik. Very good food. I would recommend it. And I took this photo, and then a lot of people on social media sent me back a photo of Tom Hiddleston, sure enough, in the like exact same pose outside Cafe Loki.
Because normally you do all of his vacations right after he does them and take all the same pictures, but this one was an accident.
This was
yeah.
A little accident. Well, what did he order? What did he order?
Yeah. How did he stand? Was he smiling or was it a serious one?
He was smiling. He's always smiling. So yes, I would recommend Reykjavik and Iceland for from New York. It's a very quick flight. It's a cheap flight. And there's a lot of it's a huge. I was telling you before, Sammy, huge tourism industry there. And there's a lot of maybe it's not your kind of vacation, Sammy.
I was gonna say it sounds a little nature-y for me, but
I'm not super nature-y.
Yeah, I think if you could do it, I could do it.
Okay, let's not. Come on.
It's true.
It's fair enough. It's fair enough. So yes, if nothing else from this podcast intro, take away Iceland as a good recommendation, especially if you're on the East Coast. It's a quick flight. It is expensive once you get there, though, guys.
Okay, good. Noted.
And you have to, if you're squeamish about eating whale or puffin, as I would never eat a puffin because they're adorable.
But you'd eat a whale?
I did have a couple bites of whale.
How was it?
It was fine.
Ugh, you're a monster.
Okay.
You're a monster. Oh, and we won't say who.
Yeah, this is...
But there's something crazy happening.
We like to tease things. We shot what I think is certainly in the top 10 after hours
yes.
for me over the years. And it's kind of... I hate kind of teasing it because we're probably going to hold this for at least a month because the project the person is promoting doesn't come out for a while.
Hint.
So, yes. So here are the hints that I will offer. It is somebody that, though I've done a bunch with... has never done a full-on scripted after-hour sketch with.
Correct.
And this person, I would say, is generally regarded as one of the finest actors on the planet.
Correct.
That's all I'm going to give right now. Because you guys have over a month to guess.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe make a meal of it.
Someone, I still can't believe you got Barack Obama to do an after-hours. Oh, my God.
Someone on Twitter did already...
I saw.
Guess.
And I wanted to... fuck with you and like their answer, and I knew that would just ruin your life.
You know, in this time of despair and potential nuclear war and the decline of the healthcare system,
there are good things still happening.
Yeah. We here at After Hours are still delivering.
We're taking care of you.
We're taking care of you guys. So, yes, if we all survive another 4 to 6 weeks, you'll have an amazing After Hours sketch. I think the internet will really enjoy.
We should have it, like, if anything happens to us, to still release it.
Just put it in a capsule.
Yeah.
As they go through the detritus of the post-nuclear warfare, yeah. They find a canister.
And it's up in the sky.
Yes. So look forward to that. But in the meantime, if you can't hold out for 4 or 6 weeks, here's a very entertaining chat with truly one of the best actors out there, Tim Roth. Remember to check out Tin Star, coming soon on Amazon Prime. And that's all I have to say, Sammy.
I thought you kept saying Tim Star, and I was like, Tim Roth is in a show called Tim Star.
I'm Star.
Tim Star.
No. Oh. I kind of wanted to see that show, though.
Yeah, I'm a little disappointed now. I guess I'll still tune in.
Enjoy this chat. Tim Roth is taking in my office.
Looking at all your stuff.
What do you judge me as? This is basically an adolescent's office. Well, this is my 14-year-old.
Now, here's the thing.
Yeah.
You have a good mate of mine looking right over your shoulder.
Wait, which one? Kurt? Oh, of course. I mean, come on.
One of my best friends.
Kurt and Quentin were in for that
they,
film.
Did they come in?
Yeah.
Oh,
God. That was back to back. It was like an amazing 2 hours of my life.
Aren't they funny?
Oh, my God.
They're funny.
And Kurt, I mean, as you know, Quentin knows more about film than anything. And Kurt just loves to tell stories. And
they just, yeah. And the thing, I mean, we had... are we doing this?
Yeah, we're doing it.
So we had a thing on Hateful Eight. We had a coffee circle. Once we got to LA, when we'd done that up in the cold. But we had like a coffee clutch, basically.
Amazing.
And it was the lads. And whoever wasn't in there freezing their nuts off was outside in the sun having a cup of coffee or having a smoke, if that's what they were doing, and chatting.
Well, there's no phones or anything allowed. So you have no what else are you going to do? You might as well talk.
So they're sitting and they're swapping stories, and it's one of the best things you've ever seen. You'd love it on your show. And they they're just telling.
I can only imagine.
It was so fun. And then we started to do, when we couldn't find each other, we started to text each other. And we're still doing it.
I hear you, the text group continues.
It's still going. I was texting this morning.
What's the general topic of conversation?
Anything. It's catching up.
Okay.
Where in the world are you? You know, because there's a bit of that goes on. And then sending pictures to each other.
Like are we talking like GIFs or just photos of things? Like
all
are they
kinds.
Inappropriate material, hopefully?
Probably. And it's all of us. It's the mob.
There's not one of the Hateful Eight that is not a participant.
I don't think so. Everyone's just on it. And then you fade out because you're busy doing something, yeah. And it's still going. And you fade back in, you know.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I was excited to see you and Jennifer got a little mini reunion. I just finished up watching all of Twin Peaks,
how was that for
oh
you?
My God.
I haven't seen it.
It's amazing. Yeah. I mean, the fact that, like, 18 hours of new David Lynch directed material exists in the universe was just like, as soon as I knew.
That will do.
That'll do, right?
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Talk
about people that do their own thing.
He's amazing. Well, Eraserhead was one of mine when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I went to see it over and over again when I was, you know, because it was in a cinema in London that had been squatted by these film nuts.
Really?
Yeah. And they would get prints and they would show movies and you'd go along and, you know, sort of watch an all-nighter of Polish, sort of obscure Polish films and stuff. And then that showed up. And we fell in love with the woman in the radiator, the raining placentas, or whatever it was.
Yeah, for me, it was, of all things, I was 8 years old when Dune came out, and that, like, blew the back of my brain out.
Yeah.
What am I even watching?
It's crazy.
I was going to say, so there's a lot I want to talk to you about. We should mention just up front that Tin Star is the show. We're going to get to that. I really enjoyed it. I watched the first 3 episodes, so congratulations on it. I hear you already have a second season that's been greenlit.
Yeah.
That's
good news.
I was
just trying to figure out where you're at in 3.
Well, what happens?
Nothing. That's what happens.
All right. Well, let's work around. I was because yes, they pack in some major
haven't seen
twists.
It. I know what I was in it, so I know what's up.
Yeah.
But oh no, 3's.
Just getting started.
Oh, you're just getting started.
Please, the first episode. Like you think it's one thing.
That's insane. That's why I did it.
It's okay. Let's start talking that.
Yeah,
because I watched the first episode and
talk about
grabbing an audience with the first scene, and then by the end, kind of turning it on its head again. Yeah. How important is like the first scene in a script, the first couple of pages?
From what I can tell, because I haven't seen it, but it's cut differently to the way it was written. So I didn't know that was coming. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm not looking for a TV show to do. I actually don't know what I'm looking for ever. So it's just, I'm just reading something, you know. And I start cackling. Because it's good, and I can see where it's, you could play around in it and change back and forth. And then that happened. I was like, oh, where's this going? And I wanted to know. So I thought, well, that's all right then. If I do, then the audience might. Yeah. So with a bit of luck, over to you guys, you know. And then we started to play. When we started to shoot it, we started to... Because Rowan, who created it, he directed the first one. And he watched us improvising, me and the kids, both of the kids. And then, and with the mum, and trying to... Because we had a short amount of time to get this family across.
Sure.
Before devastation hits.
Yeah, I mean, we should say, without ruining it, like it opens with a burst of unexpected violence. Yes. We can say that.
Yes, I think we can say that. So I thought, I'll have a go, you know.
Rowan is the son of Rowan Joffe, who we've also worked with. That's a first, I would think.
I think it is. I think it is, actually. Yeah, we did really ridiculous costumes. With Roland, I had a wig that made me look like I had a cock on my head. It's worth checking out just for that.
Which one was that? Remind me.
Battelle.
Battelle, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in this one, I mean, were you looking for TV, or were you constantly not looking for TV?
I don't have a plan at all. That which I think is kind of a plan in itself, really, but I don't. So I don't know what's around the corner ever.
Yeah,
and then this just came, and in a way, I had done television, but I'd done television in Britain, and I'd done television like miniseries type thing.
Right.
But I'd not done a long like 10 episodes of a story that hung together. So I was quite interested in that, and they just bought the lot outright.
I mean, this kind of format, as you well know, like is kind of like the format du jour of television these days. These kind of like 10-episode kind of runs, which must for an actor be great, because you know when you did Lie to Me, that probably was like a 22-episode kind of run.
We did I think 58 in all or something.
That's grueling.
It is. I mean, it's not grueling. Like,
I mean, you're not digging ditches, but
no, you're doing all right. But it's, you've got to keep your wits about you, and you have to be, you have to have some sort of backbone. I wouldn't like to do the kind of television where you just show up, say your words, hit your marks, and bugger off. Mm. I would, I think, get very bored very quickly.
And this role in particular, I would think, because you go to some extremes, there's a Jekyll and Hyde nature to the character.
Yeah.
It's, you know, not only is there presumably an arc for this one character over 10 episodes, but you're kind of playing in a way two different characters in a sense, or two sides of a character.
Yeah. They blur, but you'll see.
Gotcha.
You're never sure. It's shown up.
But it's surprising to me because, like, I don't tend to think of a 10-episode, like a long, I mean, you know, decent-sized run of TV as collaborative. Like, usually I feel like it's more of the show up, okay, what'd they write last night, deliver the lines kind of a
maybe,
thing.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, it wasn't the way that we did it. It's certainly, and it may have been just, I'll tell you how it started was when I arrived in on the location, Calgary, which is where we based ourselves, and there was one of those awful read-throughs that you have to go through for the execs, right?
Right.
So I hadn't met the guy who's playing my boy, I hadn't met the daughter, and I hadn't met my wife.
That's crazy.
And we were starting to shoot in about 4 days. And now I had... I went right. And they were sitting on different size of the room. I went and stole all their things, put them right next to me, got the script out. I think we were reading two episodes or something for these guys. And I just started reworking. I started just sort of cut that, to move that around there. That's good. Bang, bang, bang. And started to play, and Rowan was looking at me. And then I started to wind up my daughter and the boy. I kept threatening to shave his head, and he actually took me seriously. And the missus, and we started to have, the back and forth started there because we didn't have any
time.
There
was no time, yeah.
We had no time. And it kind of, when we were filming, bled into the episode, the first one, a bit.
Yeah.
There was a lot of that back and forth, and he said, do that, play it, you know, and we were mucking about, and he was getting it. And it kind of is how we went after that. It was, they would write it, we would play with it, you know, we have to get him off on the phone half the time
because
he was busy doing whatever they do, right? And then finally, I think by the time we did one episode, which is episode 9, was improvised.
Completely improvised.
Story was absolutely bang on. Yeah,
you knew the beats you had to get to, but
and he gave us.
You're back to like Mike Lee territory, coming
bit.
Full circle.
Not really.
No.
No. But Rowan was kind of up for it, and then it's a specific episode, and that's why. And then it keys into what happens in episode 10.
I'm intrigued. Okay, excellent.
Yeah.
Do you ever pick a project based on location? You're certainly in a very interesting locale in this. You shot this where you said Calgary.
I filmed that before, bloody freezing.
Yeah.
Is
that how high does that factor in when you're taking a job? Location.
First off, it's script. You know. To be honest with you, quite often you'd just rather be home, but that never happens. You've got to go work for a living. You know, so it's okay if I have to be in Thailand or something. Let's hope I can get the kids over, and let's hope I can bring the missus, and let's, you know, and I hope it's a decent project, you know.
Yeah. Are the kids grown now? Where
they're
you
all
have
grown, yeah.
So you have a little bit more.
They're up and about, yeah. A bit, yeah.
So when I was prepping to talk to you, and I've always been a great admirer of your work. That being said, when I looked at sort of like just the filmography, the thing that really struck me was the directors that you've worked with. I want to just run through some of the list because it's an insane list of not just like great filmmakers, but like interesting filmmakers disparate. This is a tip of the iceberg. Yeah. Mike Lee, Stephen Frears, Robert Altman, Stoppard, who's never directed again, Tarantino, James Gray, Woody Allen, Wim Wenders, Nora Ephron, Tim Burton, Werner Herzog, John Sayles, Coppola, Michael Haneke, Ava DuVernay. So that's like, you know.
Oh, Ava's on there. I love Ava.
That's 20%, maybe. That's 10% of the directors you've worked with. But I don't. That to me speaks volumes of your taste, of their taste in you. Sure, of certainly luck factors in there. But like, I don't know. What strikes you about? I don't know.
I've worked with Crispin Glover.
Is that right?
From Just Back, so you know.
My Back to the Future poster.
Yeah, sorry.
He's a unique one.
He's amazing. So funny. Okay, go ahead.
So, but tell me, is there a common denominator in the directors that you're attached to? Is there, or can you kind of work with anybody?
No, I mean, I like I say, there's no structure.
Mm-hmm.
You hope to be inspired by whoever it is that you're like working with David Lynch. You know, you hope that you can live up to them and that they're worth living up to.
Right.
That's kind of where you're at.
Did any of those, that list or others kind of surprise you in terms of like the preconceived notion of what they were going to be versus?
They always do.
Yeah.
You can't, there is no preconception. Just you scrap it.
First day, see what happens.
Just get in there and start working.
Yeah. I mean, have you, and you last directed and you only directed one film.
Yeah.
Many years ago now. Yeah. And I was a great fan of that work, The Gray Zone, which is a tough film to say the least. Did that change you as an actor, you think, in terms of your relationship to directors, having gone through that?
No, I think, yes. Well, actually, yes, and yes, yes, it did. I did it because enough directors, I'd been annoying enough directors, I think, with my opinions and mouth about shit, that I feel like, just go do your own film,
right?
You know? So there's that, you know? But when The Warzone came, it was in book form. They had tried to do it before. Danny Boyle was attached at one point.
Oh, wow.
Barbara Broccoli.
Bomb producer, of course.
As well, yeah. And it just couldn't get it off the ground, so we started from scratch.
Was that a story that you felt? I mean, you've talked openly about the abuse that you suffered and your dad suffered, and this is a film for those that haven't seen. Sure. That's about sexual abuse within a family. Yeah. It's a tough thing to watch, but it's a great piece of work. It really, and Ray Winstone, obviously, it's one of our
amazing,
finest.
Right?
I mean, amazing.
I know.
Did that feel like a story, even though it wasn't your story per se, a story you had to tell at the time, or
I felt it was in safe hands because. The thing is that Alexander Stewart, who wrote the book, didn't write it because of that. He wrote it because his son got very ill and died, and he wanted to write something about how precious life is and those relationships. And that's how it came about, the book. I think he used that as a device to deal with it. And there were elements in the book that, having been on the inside of it, just felt wrong. And so we talked. He worked very, very, very closely with me on scripting it. And I said, "I got you on this one. I got you back."
was your dad around at the time? Was he?
No, he was gone. I wish he'd seen it. He probably wouldn't have seen it. He was very funny. He wouldn't come to the theatre when I was doing plays and that, because it can't be in crowds. He was a tail gunner in bombers.
Wow.
In the Second World War. He had a tough old life, that fella. He was from here. He's from New York.
Did he live to see your film work at all?
He saw Made in Britain, and he called me up, and he was crying, and he said, "I didn't know you could do that." I said, "No."
Join the club. Me and the rest of the world.
Yeah, right. And he was happy for me.
So he was born in Brooklyn, right?
He was Sheepshead Bay.
Amazing. So was he... Did he have like dual citizenship? Did he spend time here at all,
know.
Or is he?
My family is such an enigma. They're bonkers. but no, he was here until he was about, I think it was 11, and then they got on a ship and they went to Liverpool first. And he was put to work in the factories there, and then I think a brief stint in the paper mill down in Kent. But the factories were so rough that they threatened to run away. And so the family moved down to the hop fields, which is in Kent in the south of England. And they were put to work in the fields there. So when the war happened, he was 17. So that's 6 years after being in the States.
Yeah.
He joined the Air Force. He ran away underage. And it was better to go to war. And what he was living.
Telling.
Yeah, right. So he went off and he was in the back end of bombers for 4 years or so. Yeah.
It's amazing to think just in the span of like, three generations, your father, the childhood he had, childhood you had, and your kid's childhood.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of...
Yeah. My boy in London is a man. In London is an actor now as well. And I've got a musician and probably a director as well tucked away in there. So, yeah, they're all... It's better than... they're definitely having a better time of it, I think.
What was your relationship with like American culture growing up? Did you have much? Was it mostly like British film or British actors you were interested in, or was it American?
No,
stuff?
You wanted to. It was proper movies. You wanted to. You just the Americans. It was always that. The idea of it is quite phenomenal. I mean, the idea of I worked in a supermarket. I worked in a pharmacy. We call them a chemist. I've delivered newspapers and I delivered milk. Those are the other jobs I've had. And I've acted and directed, and that's it. So I was very... Oh, I did sell advertising over the phone to people who couldn't afford it and didn't want it.
How were you with that?
Crap.
Crap. No, persuasive. Your heart wasn't in it?
My heart was not in it. But they used a lot of out of work actors to do that kind of job.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Improv skills.
Yeah. They give you a script.
So when did was it Made in Britain that ended that other life in terms of like side jobs?
No, not really. What happened was there was a teacher at my school who spotted me. I auditioned as a joke, but I asked her later what she saw, and she said, "I thought you were in danger." And she said, "I grabbed you." And she's one of those people. She's an amazing woman. This woman, Jill Walker's her name. And ended up moving up into the north and looking after her kids. And she's one of those fantastic people. So she snagged me and put me in this bloody play at school, and then started to get me, this is how you audition, right. This is how you get to do this, go, okay, I know that they're looking over at this community theatre, there's this group, there's this, you know, and she started to help me find my feet. And then once that happened, you start to think for yourself a bit, you know. Yeah. And then I just got belligerent. I got very. Meanwhile, I went to art college.
Right, sculpture. Yeah, right? Yeah.
And they told me to. I was taking the piss because I was off acting. So they said, go find out if you want to be an actor.
Was she right? Were you like getting into trouble? Did that focus you and kind of
channel? Yeah, we were running away from school basically, and we were hiding out in the West End, and I would have been in very bad trouble, I think. Yeah.
Who were your contemporaries at the time? I mean, I think of, like, you know, people bunch you in with, like, Oldman and Daniel Day-Lewis. They were a couple years older than you, but, like...
Gary was coming up.
Yeah.
I saw Gary on stage, and he was incredible. He's a great theater actor. That is what you guys haven't seen.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would kill to see him do that again.
Yeah, he's got that. He's got the chops. anyway, but really, the reason I wanted to be in film, the reason I got to is Ray Winstone. And I went to see Scum in the West End in London, and I saw it like three times in a row, and I just was mesmerized by him. And Phil Daniels too, who's in that too. Phil, because of Quadrophenia, obviously, and I'm sure he's sick of hearing that, but it's true. And then I got to work with him. But Ray, watching Ray in that film was just one of the most amazing experiences. And I said, I want to be that. I want to be that. And my first job, which is Made in Britain, was directed by the same guy. And then my first time as a director was with Ray.
So did you have to fight for Ray for your film?
Yeah. I'll tell you, that guy is as bold as they come. I put him on the back of my mind, because Gary had just used him in Nil by Mouth, you know.
Right, right.
And I was like, right. Oh man, I'm gonna get shit for it. I'm meeting actors, and it was quite astounding. People really wanted to come and do it. And I thought, I'll get him in, for fuck's sake, get him in. So I've got this thing, it's about five flights up. It's a tiny little office I'm set up. I can hear the sound of these footsteps. And he walks into the office. And he's out of breath. And he's dressed head to toe in Russian military camouflage outfit. Head to toe. Like that. And he's like, hang on a minute. So he catches his breath. And I'm just watching him. And I said, we sat down, he said, well, it'd be good to play a good guy for a change. And that was his first line.
That's amazing.
And I went, that's the guy. That's because if you take that out of the film, just take that piece in the bunker out. Prove it.
Right.
There it is. And he's so accurate. And you couldn't deny the force that came into that room. Incredible, that actor.
It's interesting, because I confess, and I'm like a huge film geek. It took me a while. I mean, I had seen him in your film, but like, it was relatively later in his career that in the States here, I feel like, that we came to appreciate.
Yeah, you guys got him late.
We did. We didn't see
him. Definitely did. Scorsese got all of him, you know.
Right, for Departed, of course, yeah.
But he'd been about. He
was a working, successful actor. He just hadn't gotten...
Oh, God,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's quite a thing. I mean, considering, you know, where he was dragged up.
Did you have rivalries or feel like competitive with your peers at the time? I mean, you and Gary appeared in a couple of films together, I think.
We did too. We did Mike Leigh thing, Meantime, and then Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, which was a laugh. No, I was kind of inspired. I mean, I would get nervous meeting them because they were, a lot of them were already up and running. I mean, they were serious contenders.
He had a bit of a head start on you.
Whoa, man, yeah. And he was bloody good. No, you just steal.
Unabashedly.
Oh man, look at that guy go. Whoa. And the idea of coming to America came from Gary, because Gary came over to do State of Grace, and he was telling me about it. And I was like, what a great idea. I mean, fuck it, there's no English over there at the moment, right? And there's plenty of room for pasty-faced London.
As we now know,
because
yeah.
They're all, well, no, well, that's it, I know. But we were the first ones. Yeah. He built the bridge and I climbed on it.
And was it Reservoir Dogs that really was the awakened for the American audience?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that, I mean, Quentin, correct me, I'm sure, but I think the reason that he was interested in me, Quentin was interested in me, was because of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, oddly.
Strangely, Tom Stoppard's only film he's ever directed.
You know why? He said, because a lot of people wanted to direct that. I think Scorsese wanted to direct it.
I don't doubt it. That script's amazing.
Which he wrote that when he was 27.
Insane.
Yeah. But he said, I'm the only one that will treat the material with any kind of disrespect. And it's healthy.
You need that.
Yeah. And he's also cheaper.
So we have to address the influence on each other of you and Quentin.
Right.
When did you know that this guy had the stuff to back up his bluster?
20 pages in. I already knew. You just knew. You reach for the fun. You cannot believe what you're looking at. If you go back and look at that script, you can see there's a great filmmaker at work. I didn't know that he'd already had to sell True Romance,
Natural Born Killers.
Yeah. I didn't know that. He told me all of that later. But no, 20 pages in. You already know.
And I probably at some point have read some of his scripts years ago, but like everyone always says, like you read his scripts and they read like
great to read.
Novels.
Great
like
read.
Brilliant. Yeah. The stage directions are as entertaining as the dialogue.
Oh, yeah. When we did the reading of Hateful Eight, of the script that got leaked, and he read the stage directions. And it was the most fun. And he would talk to the audience as well.
I'm sure he's a hand.
And he would slap us about a bit as well. I mean, if we were taking too long with something.
He's workshopping it then. He was figuring it out.
He's amazing.
I read something somewhere, this might be not true at all. Was there ever talk that you and Gary were in line for Pulp Fiction for the for Vincent and Jules? Have you ever heard that?
No, I've never heard that.
Okay.
No, I've never heard that one.
So we already addressed that the text group continues. So you and Quentin are friends outside of these collaborations.
We chat.
Yeah.
You know, I saw him the other night because it's a quarter of a century since we made that one.
Yeah.
So we had a bit of a get-together in LA and one up here we did. But yeah, we see each other. You know, the thing about Quentin is he's always on the move and he loves to go see movies. So he will just go to a festival.
Right.
And he will, you know. And then while he's doing that, he's writing.
I know. And I'm so curious. When he was in here, he talked about... I'm curious about the stuff we've never seen. Like, have you read some of his scripts that... Or film criticism that he's written? He said he's been, like, writing film criticism for years. He's going to publish a book at some point. Like, have you read some of the stuff that we've never seen?
No. And he's told us about it, too.
Yeah.
And we're all like...
Yeah.
Let's have a look.
That's that mother word.
But he's just... I mean, my God. He's an encyclopedia.
Truly.
They had a game going on set, Bruce Dern and Quentin.
Yeah.
That we were just rolling our eyes. The two of them.
Oh, man.
Crazy. It was, Bruce would name an actor, I think, and you'd have to name three things that person had been in.
I don't want to be good at that game, I can't.
They were really trying to outdo each other. Like, really trying to, I don't think he ever got Quentin. He might have got Quentin once, stumped him.
Right.
But the two of them going at it. They'd be across the room.
I'm sure.
And then we're all sitting there like this. Get on with it, would you? I
was telling you when you walked into the building, like how I've kind of given up the junket thing as we all hoped one day. And I think one of the last ones I did was for that film. And I remember talking to Bruce and he is so not a junket guy, i.e. like I asked him like, they were rapping me. They're like, you have 1 minute. I asked Bruce a question and he gave a 10 minute anecdote about working with Hitch and everything.
Oh, yeah.
It was just amazing.
Oh yeah, no, he's the thing, you know. That's what, you know, you want to be with a fast speaker,
right?
When we're doing it, you know. Had a two of them, honestly. But he's just intriguing. He talks to me about football, English football clubs. He's crazy about that,
right? He's a bit of a gambler, right?
Well, he was a runner.
That's right,
you know, marathon runner. Yeah. He was the real deal. Yeah.
Have you read the Manson Project that Tarantino's got?
No, he told us about it, but. You know, we stay away.
You're like, when you're ready, now, after the debacle on the last one, you don't want to be the one to leak anything.
So That was so infuriating.
Did we ever get to the bottom of
that script?
Do you know who?
No.
Where that went?
I'm saying nothing.
Okay. I think you have your theories. I want to hit some random things.
Okay.
I'm a big fan of Everyone Says I Love You, the Woody Allen film. I really am.
Have I seen that one?
I recommend it.
I have seen it. You know why? I wanted to be in a musical. And my wife loves musicals. But I wanted to find out what the moment was like where you stop speaking and you start singing.
The song. That's a big moment.
I want to know what that... And then the afterburn of that. Mm. See, I got to experience it just for a second.
Did it feel like...
It's weird.
You're jumping off a ledge, or was it...
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. And you've got the click track going and you're having your conversation and then here it comes and then you've got to go for it. The thing about Woody Allen, when his deal with that was that you could choose if you wanted to sing or not. It was up to
interesting.
You. And it wasn't about being a great singer. It was about the actors doing that. And some of the voices in it, bloody awful. Mine was too, but it didn't. I just wanted to experience it.
But there's an unexpected, it sounds like you haven't seen it, but there's an unexpected kind of poignancy for me to see kind of like these non-professional singers kind of just...
I think so. I think it's
open themselves up. It's
myself.
Yeah.
But I know I did watch that one. The reason I can say I did watch that one because I kind of sat with my wife and watched it. And she just started crying.
It's
a sweet
movie.
Result.
Planet of the Apes has its fans and detractors. I will say, like, even in a film that's flawed, there are a couple of truly great performances in there. One of them is yours. I would put Giamatti is doing some really cool stuff in there.
It's
great.
Hilarious.
Do you have... Fawn, I mean, the makeup must have been insane. Is it?
I would fall asleep while they were doing it, and then they just popped me up when I needed me to sit up. They wake me up.
So you,
I was down with it. I was fine.
You enjoyed it.
I had the best makeup crew ever. It started off as a 5-hour makeup and ended up as a 2.5-ish. They were incredible, and I just kind of I've always liked the physicality of things. So I just the guy who was my stunt double. Is Terry Notary.
Yeah.
He's amazing.
He's done stuff on the New Apes films film too, right? Yeah.
And so we would just get into it.
Yeah.
We had the best time.
Have you done or are you interested in like the performance capture stuff? Is that kind of thing?
I've only done it with the Hulk. I've not done it any and we brought Terry on on the Hulk from I said, you've got to get this guy, he's incredible. And he did the Hulk.
Interesting.
Yeah, and then I think he did Avatar and he's done
a ton of these.
He's such a cool
does that
guy.
Does that does the experience again on Hulk, which may have been a mixed bag for you? I don't know how you look back on it. Does that color your like willingness or interest in doing another comic book film? Have they come calling?
I'd do
you
it. I'd love
be
it.
Interested.
Yeah. Of course, yeah.
That's all
it's
they make
just
now.
Fun. You know, but you want to do? I did. I mean, that was that. You know, my dad's a monster. You know, you got your frock. My dad's a monkey, my dad's a monster. You're pretty much covered, eh?
Well, you've got some points. Psychiatric bills, too, perhaps.
No, it's fun. It's fun.
Now, is it apocryphal or true that you, speaking of Planet of the Apes, that you turned down Snape to do that?
It sounds kind of arrogant, but what had happened was I'd said yes. And they were being really, really cool about it. I got Planet of the Apes as well, they were going to fly me back and forth, and it was going to be like that, where I would be doing one, it started to make my head spin. And then, I mean, I really wanted to do the Harry Potter things because I was reading them to my boys, and I was kind of down with that. But it just, I didn't know if I was ready to stop, and I felt that if it did do what I thought it was going to do and did do, it would be a hard one for me to break out of and try and get back to work.
Yeah.
For me, I wasn't ready yet.
Well, even I mean, you know, the late, great Alan Rickman, I mean, I spoke to him.
He's perfect, though.
He was amazing. But I spoke to him actually just a few months before he passed, and he had just directed a film finally. He had returned directing, and it took him a while, partially because of...
his DP.
Is that right?
Yeah. I called him up. He's one of the first people I called up to ask him for advice.
Amazing.
He's one of the only actors that he directed. Did Winter's Guest?
Yes, Winter's Guest, and then he did one right before his passing,
right.
Actually.
So
yeah.
I called him up, and I said, have you got anything to tell me, any kind of recommendation? He said, sleep. Just get lots of sleep. And that was it.
When you eventually saw his interpretation of Snape, was there any bittersweetness? Like, oh, I would have done it a different way?
It would have been very different.
Yeah.
And that's okay, too. Mm. No. I was actually thinking about it today. You were talking, it came up, and I wonder if they would have let me play it the way I wanted to play it.
Well, that's intriguing. What was your take on it?
It would have been a very different guy.
No,
it was just what came to my mind when I was reading it boys. Well,
elaborate. You can't just leave me hanging like this.
He would have been... No, it doesn't matter. But very different. As he would have been different from any actor.
Sure.
I mean, you bring what you got, right? I would have brought a different bag of tools along.
I want to mention one film that I've only seen once, partially because it's a great film, but it's also talking about films that are a tough thing to watch. Funny Games is maybe the toughest film to watch for an audience.
It was horrible to be in.
Michael Haneke.
I love him.
I mean, an amazing
filmmaker. It's
not
about that. I found it personally very, very difficult. I found it's hard to do because he shot the whole thing in sequence. So you start...
You're going on that journey.
You're going on it. And you start your day that way, where you've left off the day before. And it was incredibly distressing. And the boy, who I loved, looked just like my son. And I just couldn't get my head around it. I think it was heartbreaking, that being in that.
Well, it's almost like...
And then
it's
Naomi was like bold as brass. There she goes. You know, you got to love Naomi, right?
But it just feels so like, at least I remember at the time, it felt like the reality of it was almost too great to handle. Like, this is what it would be like to go through a horrific home invasion.
Yeah.
that's a virtual reality I don't need to experience.
And you know, Brady and Michael were brilliant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They were brilliant.
Yeah.
They were just as sweet as they come, and it was very... I mean, you're working with proper goods, so you're all right. It was all in my head.
Yeah.
That it was one of those ones that I just couldn't shake it.
I
could not deal with it. It was tough, and I didn't have the toughest part. Weirdly, right.
I'm surprised it took this many years for you to work with David Lynch. Actually, that feels like that's a match that could have worked on many different films.
Yeah.
Had you ever discussed anything before Twin Peaks?
No, not with him. With his daughter.
Jennifer.
Jennifer. She was going to direct me in a film, and he was going to play my dad. Maybe one day we'll get to do it, but that's about it.
Hmm.
But he's heroic, you know. His film making is, and his television, astounding. So I just was like, "Yep, what do you want me to do?" And unbeknownst to me, cast Jennifer. And it was like, and he didn't cast us because we're in Hateful Eight. He just thought we'd be good together. No, actually,
that's very true. Very right. Good instincts.
I love him for it.
Are there certain directors that you're surprised or disappointed you haven't worked with yet? I mean, like, you know, I think I watched something like Ten Star, and it has a little Coen Brothers thing to it. I would say maybe
they don't have me.
What?
They've got Steve.
For Buscemi and Tim Roth.
They've got Steve. They won't have me.
Do you find that you go up for the same roles? You're interchangeable?
No, I don't know. He's just... Oh, God, he's an adorable man. But no, not really. He's busy. I'm busy.
Right.
But we saw each other recently for the first time in a long time. I remember sitting with Steve. Steve was having a tough time, man. Trying to get a job.
Yeah.
When I was actually doing Funny Games, we met up over in Brooklyn in the studio there. And next thing you know,
I wonder was it Boardwalk that kind of revived
before
it?
Before that happened.
Yeah, Boardwalk Empire.
And there he went.
Huh.
You gotta love that. I love that stuff.
A little prestigious HBO show can do a lot for somebody.
A little, yeah. God, it's incredible.
Was there a fallow period for you where you felt like, okay, I had my run and it's just drying up? It feels like you've worked pretty continuously.
I always feel that. I do. I have a very, very healthy fear of unemployment. And that's a very British thing.
Is that where it comes from?
I think so.
Yeah.
And seriously fierce work ethic. Like, yeah.
Is it...
Annoyingly so, I think.
But it's not self-doubt in your ability. You know you've got the chops and you're, without tooting your own horn, you know you can do the job.
Yeah, but you want to keep everyone going.
Mm.
I mean, that's the other thing. you know, you look after the family and you got to keep that cracking along.
Right.
And I like that. And so, this was 6 months away from the mob. And was going back to do another 6 months on it. And I would fly out as much as I could to home, which is in California. But even so, it's a long time to be away.
Yeah.
And it's hard. I'm driven by unemployment.
And I think it's healthy, maybe.
I think it probably
keeps
is,
you going.
Yeah.
What's the longest you go without working? Are you always, is it just like a month or two and then on to the next?
No, the best situation to be in is if you know when the next one is and you've got a gap. That was good. I had that when we did Lie to Me. I was like, I'm going on holiday.
Yeah, bye. It's the closest to a day job an actor has, or theater, I guess, but that doesn't
network.
Pay.
Network is.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That's so, a whole different animal.
Because I think you said at some point that like you thought by 50 it might oh, not, yeah. it might.
I thought maybe mid-40s it wouldn't be happening. And then it just started to get even more weird.
Well, I was going to say, I think for a male actor in particular, actually the roles kind of get more interesting.
Well, it got really weird. It got really like, oh, all right, yeah, I'll do that. I'll have a bit of that. And, you know, and you start to go, and then it really got quite wild. I was talking to my wife about it, that, you know, that they gave me a TV show to do. I think that's all right.
I'll have a go at that, sure.
I'll take a bit of that. You know, and then they want to do it again.
Yeah.
It was good. It's been just this incredible ride. But taking, really ignoring structure is the most important thing for me, I think, in that although it's scary, you don't know what the next job is going to be.
Right.
And doing Lie to Me was interesting because it was just an experiment for me. I just thought, oh, I'll see if I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't care about the barrier between TV and film. They can go screw themselves. I don't come from that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I just had a go. And it was like, oh, this is kind of interesting. I hated it at first and then really liked it by the end.
Do you consume much in the way of TV and film? Are you?
No, I'm all movies. Except my kids. We have a couple of things that we do. I'll tell you. One of the things that we have in my house when the boys are around is crap movie night. And you get to pick a crap movie, right? Mm-hmm. And you sit there, you have a beer, and you watch it, and you just enjoy it because it's such fun. Right. I'm not saying which ones I would never say.
Okay.
But it's a thing that we do in our house. I've been in some of them. So, you know. And then, believe me.
Are you giving live commentary on your own films? Or you say
they do. The boys, I get grief. And then
I think you can make big money on a podcast just commenting on your own films.
Just this sort of little camera in the kitchen. And then the other thing that they've done, that binge watching thing, which
sure.
They started me on, I'd never done before, which is now this is how people watch their telly, right? So we binge watched Rick and Morty, right? Which was excellent. And I want to do a voice on that so badly.
I really
want to do it. And then Walt's television show came out. Vice Principals. Oh,
I haven't seen the new season yet, but
God. So we sat, we watched the whole lot. and of course they know him a bit, so they crack. It's so funny. And then my middle boy made me watch, which wasn't hard, Wet Hot American Summer. We started with the movie and then both of the TV seasons.
Amazing.
And we watched a lot and it was such a laugh. We had a great time doing it together.
Have you done like any comedy on that extreme and that absurdity level?
Four Rooms, I guess, but farcical a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was more cartoon.
Yeah.
Is
that out of your comfort zone? Is that?
Oh, no, I'd have a go.
Yeah.
I'd have a go. I was trying to do one with the wonderful Funny or Die mob.
Yeah.
But my schedule just got buggered up, so I can't do it. But they're doing something really, really good. But I did do one of their little sketches that they Funny or Die thing. I did one called Prostitute.
Okay.
Which is worth a look.
I'll look it up, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I fell in love with all of those guys. I think it's one of the hardest things to do.
Absolutely.
And you're really placing yourself in the hands of the director and the editors and all of that to get your timing. You just have to give it up to them. I've just never been invited to the party.
Well, you're hereby invited to my party. I was telling you before, I do a lot of sketches. If you look to your right, you'll see Michael Shannon on the wall doing something very stupid.
Okay. He was... I saw a movie that he did. I'm going to lose it. I was judging it. It was one of the films that we saw. Maybe it was in Venice. 99
Holmes, great.
Oh,
movie.
My God.
Ramin Barani, the director.
Heartbreaking.
Underrated movie.
Yeah.
They've just collaborated again. I'm very intrigued on Fahrenheit 451.
Oh, did they?
Wow. That's going to be intriguing.
I think he's incredible, that guy. And what I think what I liked about that was it was multifaceted, what he was doing. He's a clever actor.
I think there's a drinking game associated with this podcast every time Michael Shannon's name comes up, because he comes up every time.
He must
episode,
do, because he's got to be a
favorite.
Right?
He's the best.
Yeah.
So this is good. I mean, talking about like knowing your schedule, you probably know your schedule a bit for Tin Star Season 2.
I do.
That's good. Is that the next gig? Is that what you...
No. I'm doing... Which I can't talk about, because they haven't done the announcement nonsense yet. Okay. But I've got two movies I'm doing before, and they're both with very new directors. So I'm kind of jamming them in.
Got it.
Before I have to go up the mountain again.
Why has the Star Wars baddie thing not happened yet? This feels like inevitable that
they
this
never
is...
let me.
Jeez.
I know. I loved it. James Bond. Where's
Come
the James
on.
Bond action?
Yeah. There was, again, on the like IMDb, that said that you were in the running for Obi-Wan Kenobi way back when. Do you remember, was there any conversation?
Oh, God, man. I have no idea about that one.
Okay. Maybe lost in your
maybe,
email pile.
Maybe. I just... No. It's a friend of mine, one of the woman who plays my missus in Tin Star, Genevieve O'Reilly, she... O'Reilly.
Oh, is she the... Orly. She's the young
she's,
Mon Mothma, I think, in Rogue One? Was she in... Yes.
Yeah. So she's
connecting.
Part of the family.
She got to put a good word in for you.
Oh, God, she's so funny. Comic-Con.
So we'll have you in a Star Wars movie in Rick and Morty.
Okay.
And we'll get you... And I'm going to convince you to do a sketch here next time you're in town.
Yeah, and then something with Will Ferrell. We'll do that.
Okay.
And I want to work with Kate Blanchett, so that's definitely on the list.
I hope you never... Yeah, you and Kate.
We almost got... There was a moment where I almost directed her. Very, very early on, just when I was thinking about going back and doing another one, but I couldn't get the money together for it.
You got a few decades left to hit all these things. You'll
I'll
be fine.
There.
You'll get
but
there.
But she's astounding. Yeah, so.
Genius. Well, congratulations on Tin Star. As I said, I'm always a fan of your work, and I was very impressed by this one. I'm looking forward to seeing the rest, including episode 9, which is completely improvised, which sounds amazing.
I say that. But the thing is, I say that, and it... It came from him.
Yeah.
That's what's interesting. It's just whether the producers have got the balls to let us have a go.
It's good to have ballsy producers.
They really did. Yeah.
We'll check it out. It's on Amazon Prime, I think, September 29th, 28th, 29th. So okay. Check it out, everybody. Tim, thanks so much for stopping by today.
Pleasure.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.